Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
We are still with this Lao Tzu. We're gradually creeping up on it. We're up to 18. I may drop the whole thing one of these days and go back to it later, but anyway, right now. And this 18th chapter reads, "When the great reason is obliterated, we have benevolence and justice. Prudence and circumspection appear, and we have much hypocrisy. When family relations no longer harmonize, we have filial piety and paternal devotion. When the country and the clans decay through disorder, then we have loyalty and allegiance." Yeah. See, when we leave that central core, then we have disaster. Now, in this country particularly, we have a great deal of ethical and moral consciousness. We stem from the Puritans. And the puritanical ambience still holds great sway. And the fundamentalists, who consider themselves as being pure, you know, they're still with the puritanical thing, being pure, and having a desire to live exactly as it is stated, which is not a bad desire, you know. There's some behind that. But they want to live according to biblical terms. And they flourish in this country, of course, because this is where the atmosphere for it is, in this milieu that they live in. And they say, do not have an interpretation. Just believe as it's written. Do as it is written. But as you look around, you know, there are a great many interpretations. And we come down to the fine point of the belief of do not have an interpretation is an interpretation. Yeah. But Lao Tzu, now, in his state of consciousness, you know, which is no longer just belief, you know, he says, you know, look to nature. Look, and you will see that nature is ceaselessly striving for a balance, for an equilibrium. And the many movements of nature, you like the tides, you know, the energy swings in a direction, and let us say it swings to a positive aspect, or we could say a light aspect. When the tide flows in, it flows in aggressively. And then there is a change, and there is this passivity. For a moment, there is this balance, and then, you know, the tides ebb. The slurping sound that the tide makes as it goes out again, huh? Yeah, which is what we call a negative aspect now. Positive and negative, you know, masculine and feminine, not persons, and has nothing to do with sex. What's busload of people going by. These aspects, for the masculine, well, look at the men sitting here, masculine, huh? They all have a feminine aspect to their nature. Now, we know that, to their person. Have we looked at it? Are you coping with it? Do you know what it is? Are you integrating it into the psyche so that you can have a balance? Are you men doing this? What about you women? There is a masculine aspect. Do you know what it is? Are you balancing? Are you coping with? It takes a little energy to find it, what it is. Because the gender, like, I'm a woman, so here's my femininity on the outside. Inside, you see, there's the masculine aspect, which one discovers and begins to integrate in the psyche. And the man sits there, and he's more aggressive, and this masculine thing, and inside, he's feminine. Which doesn't mean woman as such. You all understand. Well, maybe we'll go into that a little more one of these days. But energy moves, it's on the move all the time. And so it moves from the negative to the positive, and from the positive to the negative, always striving for this balance, wants to have a balance, and once it's in a balance, it moves out of it again, because it can only contain itself there so long. So this balance sometimes we call zero, or we call empty, or as we used the word last week, ku. And some people mistake this empty or this zero as a synthesis of a plus and a minus, of a masculine and feminine, plus and a minus and a zero. That they say if you synthesize masculine and feminine, then you have got zero or empty or ku. Well, this is not the case in nature. It can be the case in logic, but nature, as we all know, is not logical. This balance, this ku, it transcends the positive and the negative. It transcends, and therefore it is neither. Now, interestingly enough, this energy, as it passes from the negative to the positive, or the positive to the negative, it passes very briefly through zero. And then it swings again the other side, and it comes down, and it passes through zero very briefly and fills, and it comes down and it passes very briefly through zero. Comes up again. When you go to sleep at night, there's this descent. You pass through zero. In the morning you wake up and there's this ascent. You go through zero. Are you aware of doing this? As you go from your mind to your feelings. Your feelings to your mind. you pass through this zero, this empty. Are you aware of it? You're not running around all over the place looking for it, and you sit right here with it. Now, like several times in every 24 hours, it depends upon the person, several times, the way you breathe changes. There are times when you inhale and exhale more through one nostril than you do through the other. It's, you know, the Enapingala currents, the currents that move up the spine and they govern a bunch of stuff here. Anyway, then the swing comes, and for a while, you're breathing evenly through both nostrils. And then the swing comes again, and it swings a little further, and you breathe more through the other nostril than you did with this one, and then it goes back and forth, the sun and the moon breath. And there's certain things you can do when it's one side or the other. So you watch, you know. I mean, how well do you know yourself? Do you know that this is going on? It might be that you breathe through one nostril for 4 hours. And then there'll be maybe 20 minutes, both nostrils, and then 4 hours on the other side. Could be 7 hours on each side. Do you know how much? Do you know this is going on? Now, Lao Tzu in this chapter is saying when we do not rely on, and this rely on means being in accord with, being in a state, when we do not rely, when we are not in that state of with great reason, when we do not rely on great reason, then we try to bring about an order in ourselves and perhaps in society, which many have done. It is as if you were trying to imitate this great reason. I mean, you know, through my head right there, it goes all kinds of pictures of what people have, the riots and everything that have come about because people were trying to bring about a state of great reason in society. And it can't be done, you know. When one understands oneself and relies on great reason, then one's actions are spontaneous. And one acts out of this coup, this zero, this balance. And it's nothing planned. You just act out of in response to the moment, in response to the situation. It's not something you've sat there and planned all around. You're just meeting. It's a kind of an acting in an innocence, as it were. And Lao Tzu is saying, when we cannot do that, then we try to act out some form of justice that we have devised for ourselves. We try to have some benevolence in our world. We try to act circumspectly, you know. And therefore, hypocrisy appears. We are not doing what comes naturally. We're trying to imitate, and it distorts what we're doing. Furthermore, he also said that he found that by putting an emphasis on the one side or another of this balance, let us say you put an emphasis on this positive aspect, if you're so overemphasized with it that you get in the way of a natural order of this swinging, and this has an effect on the negative aspect, It has, if you're so focused on one side, something happens to the other side because it's still looking for a balance, no matter what you may think. So if a person concentrates highly, I mean is highly concentrated on, I must be benevolent and I must be good, and so that goodness is overemphasized, what happens? You think badness decreases? It's the opposite. You're fueling it. You're giving fuel to the fire, huh? It increases. So if you stress morality, what you see in the world? More immorality. Yeah. There's always this, in nature, this push to balance. Push to the center. And if a person really tries to understand life, to really understand, and, you know, in a way, that's what this is all about, understand. In understanding, we should come to, we can see that we would come to a conclusion that always and ever there is this basic striving for balance, for this equilibrium. Equilibrium is freedom. Balance is perfect freedom. You're free from the duality. You're free from the opposites when you're the center. Yeah. Nothing is so very good, and nothing is so very bad. To play freely in this world, one must not pursue, and at the same time, not run away. Not run after, you know, and not run to. Not run away, not run to. Just be free. And you know, we look around, you know, and we can see that people, you know, they have these illusions about themselves and about God and about what society should be and what they would like it to be. And, you know, they're filled full of these illusions and there's suffering in them. They do, they suffer. Yeah. The root of suffering is illusion. All these wants that you build up in your illusion. We suffer from too many thoughts. We suffer from too many worries, and we suffer from too much depression and too much anxiety, and somehow or another we feel very unloved now and then, sometimes, often. So we ache, you know, for something or someone to come along and take this away from us. And the root of it all is your mind, is your thinking. Rich man suffers and a poor man suffers. You know, it's like you have fire in a stove and you have fire in a fireplace and you have fire with a candle. And now fire isn't only just a material thing that you might see. There's a fire in the mind. Yeah. And that's very important. One should observe this fire in the mind. Well, your mind, you can be very tranquil sitting there doing something, and somebody comes along and says something, and the mind goes, whoops, you know, and then watch it. Shoom! Like it's on fire. Yeah. You know, if we're feeling left out, alienated, depressed, whatever, you know. Who lights that fire? Also, you know, we should remember that we are dependent upon each other. We are all tied together, as it were. And in these objective self-conscious states, We think we are separate and apart. I mean, the world is filled with objects. You know, here I am and I see all these objects, every flower, everything, every other person are all separate from me. And in all these objects now, how do you know what is good and what is bad? Because you compare to another object. Because of each other, we can say that. Because of the other objects. How come you have a job? Because of others. And other people. Without people, no jobs. No jobs, no money. No money, no eat. It's very simple. But also, we not only share, we have places, you know, where we're in society that we have created for ourselves. And if you don't like where you are, create something else. I mean, society is going on and on and on and on. You fit in there someplace. Not only do we share places in society, but we share illusions. We borrow them one from another. And we share isms, and we borrow them one from another. We share this one earth, and we are one vine. The elements of this earth constitute our bodies. And there is this, what is called in the Christian Bible, one vine, which is one consciousness. We are interdependent, one upon the other. And people are running around like crazy looking for happiness. You ask them once when you see somebody doing this, what is happiness? What form does it take? Happiness. Does it have a form? Well, actually, you can't. Everybody in this room, if you all decided you wanted to have a category for happiness so that you could tell everybody what happiness is, I wonder how long it would take before you could agree. Because each one of you is looking for something different. And yet you're all looking for happiness. So we can't really decide anything about it. And you can't really put it into any category. But there is this constant striving, I should be happy. Why am I not happy? I'm going to be happy somehow or another. And it puts us in a bondage. It limits us. It limits our thinking and it limits our feelings. So what is this happiness you're all running around looking for? What is it? All existences have the same root. And it has nothing to do with morality. It is true law, this root. And in this root, your happiness is my happiness. My happiness is your happiness, which is a very true precept. And if you understand this, then you understand morality at the root. Not something that is devised in your mind, which limits your understanding. Are you with me? Am I speaking beneath you? You know, mankind, we all of us as such, we have a desire that goodness should prevail. Everything should turn out good. You know, our movies and our books and all that in the age of romance back in the 40s and the 50s and the, well, in 30, 40, 50. The 60s took it away from us. Yeah, no more age of innocence. Romance was gone. Now the stories, you're hanging in air and you figure it out for yourself. The songs did the same thing. Before it was always nice and cut and dried. They got married and naturally they lived happily ever after. So people didn't know how to cope. I mean, the movie ended. I mean, they got married. Now what? We have always had a desire also that there should be light. More and more and more and more light. So that the darkness be banished forever. And we have always wanted life without death. You know? And we have always wanted happiness with no unhappiness. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully by now you've sat there and figured out that this just simply isn't possible. No. Not as long as you move from one polar opposite to the other. You pick up one, you pick up the other. You watch yourself. You run from this to that, from that to this, and then you run back again. You even do that in your thinking. You're proing and conning like crazy sometimes. In the Bhagavad Gita, which is that epic poem about two warring countries, they are the Kauravas and the Pandavas. And there is an enmity between these two countries. And, you know, there always has to be at least two. Otherwise, there's no fight. Without opposition, what are you going to be enemy to? Anyway, these two armies are interrelated. They're cousins. But you see, they're enemies. So they have this interdependency. But they're cousins. There's uncles. Relatives on both sides. And here comes this warrior in his chariot, Arjuna. And the chariot is driven by Krishna. And Krishna is the equivalent to, in India, what we would call here Christ. So they come up to the battlefield, and here the warriors are arrayed on both sides with their arrows and their shields and, you know, all set to go. And Arjuna looks at this array of fighters, and he can't believe it. He's going to fight his cousins. He's going to fight his uncles. He's going to fight his relatives. My God, you know? And he turns to Krishna, and he says, I don't want to fight my relatives. What shall I do? And Krishna turns to him and says, fight! You are of the warrior caste. Do not be a coward. And then comes a kind of an explanation in there, which you are all very familiar with. It starts with, thou grievest where no grief should be. We use it for a memorial services. But then, after that is, and which I'm not going to read because you are familiar with it, most of you, then Krishna continues, and he says, faith, yea, a little faith. Faith shall save thee from the anguish of thy dread. Here, glory of the Kurus, shines one rule, one steadfast rule, while shifting souls have laws, many and hard, spacious, but wrongful deem the speech of those ill-taught ones who extol the letter of their Vedas, saying, this is all we have or need, being weak at heart with wants, seekers of heaven, which comes, they say, as fruit of good deeds done, promising men much profit in new births for works of faith. In various rites abounding, following whereon large merit shall accrue towards wealth and money. Albeit wealth and those who wealth and power do most desire, least fixity of soul have such, least hold on heavenly meditation. Much these teach from Vedas concerning the three qualities. The three qualities are the tamasic, rajasic, and the sattvic. The three qualities. But thou, be free of the three qualities, free of the pairs of opposites, and free from that sad righteousness which calculates. Self-ruled, Arjuna. Self-ruled, Arjuna. Simple, satisfied. Look, like as when a tank pours water forth to suit all needs, so do these Brahmins draw text for all wants from tank of holy writ. But thou want not, ask not, find full reward of doing right in right. Let right deeds be thy motive and not the fruit which comes from them. And live in action, labor, make thine acts thy piety, casting all self aside, contemning pain, gain, and merit, equable in good or evil. Equability is yoga, is piety. Yet the right act is less, far less than right thinking mind. Seek refuge in thy soul. Have there thy heaven. Scorn them that follow virtue for her gifts. The mind of pure devotion, even here, casts equally aside good deeds and bad, passing above them. Unto pure devotion devote thyself. With perfect meditation comes perfect act, and the right-hearted rise more certainly because they seek no gain. Forth from the bands of body, step by step to highest seats of bliss. When thy firm soul hath shaken off these tangled oracles which ignorantly guide, then shall it soar to high neglect of what's denied or said. This way or that way in doctrinal writ, troubled no longer by the priestly lore, safe shall it live and sure, steadfastly bent on meditation. This is yoga and peace. You know, then the yoga systems that he describes, and in this Bhagavad Gita, he describes all four of them. And these are just the two, you know, work, action, the labor, which is called karma yoga. Karma meaning action. Karma yoga, and be devoted in thy soul, which is bhakti yoga. Have the feelings dwell on the core, on the center, wherein is the true self. And devotion and laboring for that self and not for gain. But then, you know, people say, well, if it's not for gain, then for what? Why do anything then if I'm not going to gain something out of it? I should at least get some merit. I should get some good marks in heaven. Or I should at least have a gold star in my crown, in my halo. Right? You know, it's still like this emperor that met Bodhidharma. And, you know, and he built the temples and everything. And he says, look what I've done. I've done this for you and your teaching. And I've done this for the people. I've done it this for this and for this and for this reason. You know, What merit shall I receive in heaven, or what merit shall I receive here? And Bodhidharma says, none. Nothing holy, nothing sacred. A little hard, but... You know, what's the matter with this trying to do this thing so that you can have a real understanding? To really understand. And real understanding is at the very core of it all. You have to reach there. Then you will understand. To so carry this meditation from the center, or whatever you want to call it, you know, that's what's important. To carry it. To act out of it. To think out of it. To feel out of it. Then you will have a right attitude when it comes from the center. Then you will have the right attitude. And in the right attitude, doing what needs to be done, you do it spontaneously. It is just done. You don't think about it. Your desires are not in it. See? And then you don't look for all the results after that either. Because it's not yours. So the situation remains in a balance then. As soon as you want something, whoops, the teeter-totter goes. You run to the other side, and whoops, the teeter-totter goes. This right attitude from the very center of yourself, we could call it Tao. There is no desire in it, no ego. It is the way, it is the Tao. It is the balance. It is the way to move. You move in it. It is the way to feel. It's a balance. And see, at that point, there's understanding. When we slip from that center, from that state, you know, this is, you know, what he's talking about, on decline of the Tao. See, the doctrines of humanity and justice arise. We devise many things to take its place. Not being able to act out of it, we devise laws about it. Just think, if everybody could act out of that center, what a different world it would be. Then we wouldn't have people running around trying to save the world. No. You know, we don't live in pure consciousness. We live in a qualified consciousness. Objective self-consciousness. And that has strings to it. You know. If one were able to live all the time in pure consciousness, which is present now with you, each and every one, if you could live there, what need would you have to think of doctrines or laws? You wouldn't, would you? No. But when we slip from there, then we have to this struggle to return. And so in this struggle, we come up with all kinds of ideas about humanity and all kinds of ideas about ourselves, and we think how humanity should act and how others should act upon humanity. And then we get little by little more rules and more laws and more regulations. And then in all of that, we're hollering, where is the way? Where is the way? When we can't remain tranquil in mind or Tao, then we look around for knowledge about it. Don't we? Yeah. And then, you know, furthering that, we just look for knowledge. No. I need to know all this stuff, you know. And if I know all this stuff, then I can do something about injustice. Yeah. We make ourselves quite clear. Whereabouts we're at. Yeah. There isn't any doubt, of course, that the bulk of knowledge, which in its place is very proper and very needed, but to find the way in the knowledge is what is difficult. But knowledge is increasing. Has increased through the years and will continue to increase by leaps and bounds. Believe me. Somewhere I read some statistics that there are 5,000 books published every week. That's a lot of books. Universities and libraries are expanding all the time. Knowledge of each of the subjects has new shoots, and again, that those shoots have offshoots, right? So Oxford University now offers 360 subjects, which is a lot. And isn't it strange that all this time that we're gaining more knowledge, the more we gain, it seems like, the more we feel we are ignorant? If the knowledge doesn't really satisfy something in us all the time, the more we need to know. So, you know, in all this thing, we've come to a place where we divide knowledge. Many years ago, one doctor treated the whole body. He was a general practitioner. And we relied on him. He made house calls and all that sort of thing. Now, specialists have taken the place of the general practitioner. And we have a different doctor for the various parts of the body. And this has become so profuse that one day it's going to come about that one single specialist isn't going to be able to cope. And we're going to look at the doctors and we're going to say, they are not really adequate. Where do we turn? Well, the answer is already at hand. Oh, this is a tremendous age we're coming into. Really. People, and you can see it now, they're beginning not to rely on a human doctor. They make too many mistakes, they say. So let us consult the computers. Learn to work a computer. It may come about in maybe 100 years from now that a doctor isn't going to have to study much medicine. He's going to learn how to ask questions about symptoms. See? Then he feeds the information that he gets of these questions about symptoms into the computer. And this, you know, out comes the remedy. Out comes what's the matter. Someday when the age of information is much more established than it is now, then I wonder what they're going to develop the computer into. It's going to be tremendous. Oh, my. You know, looking ahead, there's so much at our fingertips. There's so much that is going to happen. You know, there's even talk about memory transplanting. I mean, a person like Einstein, he shouldn't be allowed just to die. You take his brain and transplant it into somebody, and they will have all of his memory. Nothing will go by the board. Knowledge can be saved. I think it's something else. I really do. I'm going to come back 100 years from now and see what they happened. Or I'll watch very carefully from somewhere. Wherever. Now, God turned Adam and Eve out of the garden because they ate of the forbidden fruit from this tree of knowledge. He told them not to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge. No. Now, you know, there's a little speculation that he said, do not touch like you will to any child, you know. That's what they want. So, and this is why the serpent or Satan or whatever you want to call him was the cause. You know, this do not touch was the cause of why that Satan could persuade Eve to taste the apple. Because he had explained to her that this fruit was forbidden because whoever ate of it would become like God. Knowledge makes a god of men. Therefore, God forbade the fruit. What more does a child need than this? Or even an adult? Eve was convinced. Knowledge is the highest excellence. Ignorance is like death. If God forbade the fruit, it was clear he didn't want them to become like him. So she made up her mind. And then she goes to Adam. And poor Adam, what choice does he have, does any man have between God and his wife? So they ate the apple. And immediately, out, raus mit him, get out of here. They're out in the street. So, and here we sit, out of the garden. So we, you and I, we're faced with this question. What to do with this knowledge so we can get back into the garden and eat the fruit from the tree of life? What are you going to do with all this knowledge that you have? You can't go back into the garden with it. What are you going to do with it? You know, it's a very surprising thing that when knowledge is gone, ignorance is gone also. You know, there's only one thing really you can do with it. You're going to sit down and do some meditation, and for the period of time while you're meditating, you set it aside. You set aside everything you know, because you're going to set aside yourself. You forget yourself. To forget the self, as they say in Zen, is to know the self. Now, if you were the only person on this planet, the only one, would you be wise or would you be ignorant? Would you be a good person or would you be a bad person? Would you be a short person or would you be a tall person? If you have no point of reference, if you have nothing with which to compare, what are you going to do? You can just be, Just be. Just be. Never mind all the becoming. Just be. It's when you meet somebody else and you say, oh, I like something about that person. See? Then you're going to become. You're going to become that which you liked in the other person, if you can. You're going to borrow it. You're going to steal it. You're going to acquire it. You build it up in yourself, in your psyche. Now, here I have it too. What do you know? But if there's nobody around, what criterion do you use? We use to measure. So Lao Tzu says you live in this world as if you did not have a measure. See, so there's no good and no bad. See, no wise, no ignorant. Non-discrimination and non-judgment. Not run after, not run away. That's very nice. Not run after, not run away. Now, in order, there was this office manager, his office and his employees were always goofing off, the employees sitting there, And they never would do their work properly. So he went to see a psychologist. And on the advice of the psychologist, he put up a sign in this office to persuade the people to do their work a little more conscientiously and not to waste so much time. And the little sign said, "Life is short. Do today what you would do tomorrow." And you know what happened? Now, it's supposed to make them take their work more seriously. So the very next day, the office had to close because the clerk ran away with the secretary, the cashier ran away with the money, and the office boy beat up the manager. This is what each one of them wanted to do, but we're postponing. So. Oh, dear. So the right way, the way, is neither morality nor anti-morality. We need to be very flexible. You know, sometimes we become very dignified. And sometimes we're very easygoing. And sometimes we need to be rather intimate with another person. And sometimes we need to be very distant. If you want to become a Buddha, and that's why you come and that's why you sit and all this, that you gather knowledge about how to become Buddha. If you want to become Buddha, you must be able to assume all these aspects, because all these aspects are Buddha. Don't limit yourself here and then say, I can only be like this. I can only be honest. I can only be truthful. I can only be good. And every day I'm going to get better and better. Be all of it. Just don't lie to me. Yeah? See. Too much attachment, you know, it creates separation. Because it isn't real compassion. It isn't real love. Not this, you know. When we climb out of our limitations, out of our boundaries, then we have got compassion. Then we've got compassion for Buddha. Think what all he goes through every day with the stuff that we do. The compassion for God, for friends, and for our family. So there is a little Chinese poem which goes, of course, in translating from another language, we usually lose the rhyming aspects of it. So anyway, this one says, do not remain on the summit of the mountain of solitude. Don't just sit on your own peak of your ego doing what you want, huh? Do not remain on the summit of the mountain, paddling muddy water by the landing stage. The highest spirit of compassion penetrates the three worlds. You must be content to be a ferryman on the sea of suffering. A little difficult, but eventually it'll sink in. If you just remember this, though, not run after, not run away. Not run after, not run away. Just stay and paddle right where you are. Run after, not run away. Okay? Okay. Thank you very much. Be interesting, I think. If you were to take that little thing, not run after, not run away, and live with it for a few days, and really try to do that with your thoughts and your feelings, and so that you would stay more with the center. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I really do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.